The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards, and this is the Armchair Traveler coming to you from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Washington Post, National Geographic Traveler, and AAA Go Magazine. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safari, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. They are selected merely for your enjoyment and edification. Now, in our previous episode of Armchair Traveler, you may remember we began a 50 states road trips featuring some of the best routes to follow in each of our 50 states. Writer and editor Mary Ellen Kennedy Duckett's series is found in the April-May 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. And in our previous episode, we featured the first 10 of the 50 states. And today we continue with the next 10, starting with number 11, West Virginia. So here we go. New River Gorge Scenic Drive is the selection. Experience the mountain state at its whitewater best on an 83-mile loop along the magnificent New River Gorge National River. The National Park Service route hits multiple park highlights, such as the 876-foot-high New River Gorge Bridge, 1,500-foot-wide sandstone falls, and the Gorge Edge Grandview Overlook, where you can peer 1,400 feet down to the New River. What an impressive sight that must be. Now on to number 12, which is Wyoming. Snowy Range Scenic Byway, or Wyoming Highway 130, Laramie to Saratoga. Dubbed the Great Sky Road when it opened in 1926, the 95-mile alternative to I-80, open late May to mid-November, is a sky-high feast for the eyes. The east-to-west drive provides the more scenic first glimpse of 12,013-foot Medicine Bow Peak rising above Lake Marie. Overnight at Saratoga's historic Hotel Wolf, a former stagecoach stop, then go for a dip in the public hot springs. Now, next are three routes that sing. These are very terse little overviews, but they'll give you an idea. First is Tennessee, which is number 13, the 1,200-mile Tennessee Music Pathway. And this loop launches this summer, which will take you all those great cities where great American music was discovered, country music, if you will, country western or Appalachian, however you want to describe it. These will be the stops, so you'll enjoy that when it opens. Number 14 is found in Louisiana. The Zydeco Cajun Prairie Scenic Byway, 283 miles through Louisiana's Acadiana. And then we head to number 15, Mississippi. Tunica to Vicksburg on Mississippi's legendary Blues Highway, Route 61. So there you go. If you're a music fan, you've got lots of options right there, Tennessee, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Now, for number 16 and 17 and 18, we have three roads to sweet rewards. If you got a sweet tooth, here you go. New Hampshire's number 16, the 47-stop New Hampshire Ice Cream Trail. Yay! Most places open May to October. Just in time, right? And number 17, Vermont, the Randolph to Montpelier Maple Trail in central Vermont, winter and spring. I've heard a couple of folks tell me about this one, and if you like maple syrup, this is the way to go. Just take your pancake mix and have fun. You can camp, too, and make it there. And then number 18, Arkansas. Arkansas's Pie Trail, which includes the state's famous possum pie. And it's not what you think. We'll have to check that one out a little later. And speaking of food, how about food-focused we're going to get started first in Georgia, which is number 19, the Dahlonega Wine Trail. You ready? The wine tasting here is down, home, and fun. There's nothing to be snobby about, says Sharon Paul, co-founder of Three Sisters Vineyards, one of seven wineries on the 39-mile trail. Wine is an agricultural product, and her tip, blood, mountain red, and Cheetos. Only in the South, right? And then number 20, Wisconsin. South Central Cheese Loop from Madison. The 167-mile tasting and factory tour loop begins and ends at Madison's Artisanal Fragmentation Shop and drive southwest to Monroe's famous Emmy Roth Factory, then on to Darlington's Brancow Cheese. Top off the taste tour at Sauk City's Car Valley Cheese Shop. Wow, just lots to do right there. And next week, we're going to start in Kentucky as we continue our food tour, okay? So more food-focused routes from three states, and then we head to states that are best known for history, U.S. history. And so we hope you'll join us for that. And as the series continues, it's called 50 States Road Trips from the Latest National Geographic Traveler. Well, we mentioned states noted for history. Writer Kristen DeGroot of the Associated Press writes in the April 9th, 2018 issue of the Washington Post about the American Revolution Museum. And it's winning a battle for tourists, and that's good news, I think, if you're a museum lover and want to check this one out. It's a new museum. And so anyway, the dateline is Philadelphia. And here we go, taking a look at the American Revolution Museum. The Museum of the American Revolution is a year old this month, and officials say it has landed a decisive victory in capturing tourist attention in a city with lots of revolutionary competition. And let's see here. In honor of its first birthday on April 19th, also the anniversary of the shots fired at the battles of Lexington and Concord in 1775 that ignited the revolution, the museum is making some additions while holding the line on its most popular exhibits. The American Revolution has always been on the razor's edge of the culture wars. We had no idea how people were going to receive this story, the revolution, as we have written it, said Scott Stevenson, the museum's vice president of collections, exhibitions, and programming. But the public response has been tremendous across the political spectrum. The campaign to build and open the museum closed at $173 million when the goal was $150 million. They opened with no construction debt and have a hearty endowment in place, he said. It's been an extraordinary year to open a museum about the American Revolution, Stevenson said, with everything from the uproar of the removal of the Confederate statues to the Second Amendment debates in the wake of school shootings. The museum's exhibit starts with the moment in New York City where citizens pulled down the statue of King George III after hearing the Declaration of Independence read aloud. Stevenson said he's overheard a number of debates from visitors about the toppling of statues around the country. Most people would agree, regardless of their political affiliation, that this is one of the moments of deep reflection of who we are as a people, he said. The American Revolution has incredible relevance. Upcoming new additions include a trip through Alexander Hamilton's Philadelphia and the opening of the Revolution Place Discovery Center, featuring recreated historical environments to immerse families. On a recent morning, the museum was jam-packed with school groups, senior citizen bus tours, and visitors from all over. Bill and Amanda Rahowski were visiting the museum from Middletown, New Jersey, with their two sons. They were in Philadelphia for the kids' spring break and had already visited the Franklin Institute, gone to a Flyers hockey game, and seen the Liberty Bell. The short films in Washington's tent were their favorites. I like that it has a modern twist with all the interactive exhibits, so the kids are engaged, said Amanda Rahowski. The museum was on the list of must-sees because it was new and because of 10-year-old Matthew, he was studying the revolution in his class. It's really interesting because there was some stuff I learned here that I did not learn in school, he said. Maud Lyon, president of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, said it's a challenge for all Philadelphia museums to get tourists to move beyond the bell, meaning the Liberty Bell. This is a major anchor that was much needed in Philly to tell the historic story we are known for, she said of the museum. From her perspective, the American Revolution Museum has done all the right things. Their inclusion of the previously untold roles played by Native Americans, African Americans, and women, and their interactive displays really create modern feel. These days, it's not easy to tell history. We have very diverse perspectives, she said. So there you go. Well, Associated Press writer Jane Haar, reporting in the April 30th, 2018 issue of the Washington Post, is going to take us to the West Coast, where she found tolerant San Francisco fed up with dirty, smelly streets. Now, this is a rather unusual travel destination story, and the reason for it is maybe you've heard some rumors about some things, people going to the Bay City. Well, this might clear them up for you. Though known for its compassion to the needy, San Francisco may have hit peak saturation with tent camps, stinky urine, and trash littering the streets, and the new interim mayor has vowed to do something about it. In the last few weeks, Mayor Mark Farrell has promised $750,000 to hire more people just to pick up discarded needles and $13 million over the next 2 years for more heavy-duty steam cleaners and pit-stop toilets. He also had workers dismantle sprawling homeless tent camps in the city's Mission District. The city, famed for its picture-perfect views of the San Francisco Bay, has long tolerated overflowing trash bins and homeless people camped out on sidewalks. Commuters routinely walk past people slumped over in transit stations, sometimes shooting up in public. But Farrell and others say the squalor has gotten out of control and that everyone should feel safe using city sidewalks. It is not humane to let the mentally ill or houseless fester outdoors, he said. The trash, our homeless, the needles, the drug abuse on our streets. I've seen it all in our cities, and it's gotten to the point where we really need to change course, Farrell said in an interview. We've gone away from just being compassionate to enabling street behavior, and that, in my opinion, is a shift that's unacceptable. It's not just the mayor who's fed up. Cleaning up the city and getting people off the streets have become key issues in the upcoming mayoral race. Many of the problems are in the city's downtown shopping and south of market corridors, but elected officials say complaints have rolled in from across the city of 850,000 residents. Adam Mesnick, who lives in the south of Market neighborhood and owns two deli shops there, said San Francisco is finally kind of melting down and that leaders have routinely ignored dangerous street behavior for years. I cannot have my family down here. I can't have visitors. I can, but I don't choose to have my nieces come here, he said. It's horrifying for my family to walk down the street here. He's not sure Farrell, who was tapped as interim mayor after the sudden death of Mayor Ed Lee in December, will be able to make meaningful change in the short time he has left before the June mayoral race. The downtown portion of Market Street, a key downtown arterial that runs from the Embarcadero through the Castros, teems with tourists, people shuffling in wheelchairs, and children on school trips. On a recent day, a man was curled up on the sidewalk at a bus stop, moving his head just inches away from a bus as it pulled up. A bystander went to check on him. The exact number of homeless people in San Francisco was uncertain, but about 7,500 were found during a one-night count in 2017. The city's logged more than 24,300 requests last year for human waste cleanup and 9,500 for needle pickup. This year, there already have been more than 8,300 requests to pick up waste and 3,700 for needles. San Francisco has budgeted $65 million out of a $10 billion citywide budget for street cleaning this year. The $13 million the mayor announced this month will go toward hiring dozens more cleaners and expanding staffed pit stop toilets. Homeless advocacy groups are critical of Farrell's plan to dismantle camps, saying the move only pushes people into other neighborhoods. The problem, they say, is a lack of long-term housing. LaWanna Tillman, 55, camps out in a wheelchair with friends on a corner they've claimed near Market Street. Most of them have been homeless for years. The women say they welcome help, but they haven't seen any offers. They first should interview us and give us housing, she said. It would take most of us off the street. San Francisco's top tourism ambassador, Joe De Alessandro, is convinced that civic leaders can fix the problem. He made the rare decision to go public about city conditions, which he says have worsened in recent years, even for a cramped city that's always been less than pristine. It's going to take some money, it's going to take some dedication, but it's very fixable, and we can make San Francisco even more magical, he said. Near the city's cable car turnaround by Union Square, tour guide Joseph Amster said he has seen more public defecation and more encounters with violent people who need medical help. He leads tours dressed as Emperor Norton, a failed 19th century entrepreneur beloved in a city that celebrates outlaws. I had somebody spit on me once. I've had a number of close calls. That didn't used to happen, he said. Not everyone agrees that the city is roiled in human misery. New York City resident John Rasnick, who was waiting to ride a cable car, said the city looks dirtier than when he was here nearly a decade ago, but he says the reaction is overblown. I'm not walking around thinking this place is filthy, he noted. So there you go. Well, from the Bay City, we're going to cross the USA, then we're going to jump the Atlantic and head for Naples, Italy. Novelist Anne Hood is going to introduce us to Italy's Rain Man as she finds shelter in Naples with a bespoke umbrella maker. Her article is from the Quest section of the April-May 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. So you ready to meet this fella? Here we go, Italy's Rain Man. Just like you, I own 7 umbrellas. They are all broken, blown inside out by the wind, torn by my cat. The metal ribs bent at awkward angles are cutting right through the fabric, which varies from cheap and flimsy to overpriced leopard or cloud print. I used to own 10, but 3 were left in restaurants, on the subway, or in somebody's car. I buy a new one almost every time it rains. About 33 million umbrellas are sold each year in the United States, a figure I'm confident comes from the fact that we lose or break our little fold-up portables all the time. In London, tens of thousands of umbrellas are left on the underground every year. I grew up watching Mary Poppins fly with her charmed umbrella and Sebastian Cabot with his proper black English one, an accessory that would not abandon them on a windy day, and one that they wouldn't abandon on a subway car or in a car. These were umbrellas of substance, umbrellas that made a statement, and like Mary Poppins and Sebastian Cabot, I want to throw away my 7 broken umbrellas and buy one that will last a lifetime. I don't have any good winter coat or fancy high heels in restaurants. Or rather, I don't leave my winter coat or fancy high heels in restaurants. I want an umbrella that demands the same respect. Though the umbrella as we know it today, foldable steel ribs under a waterproof canopy atop a cane, was invented by Englishman Samuel Fox in 1852, I don't want an English brolly. I also do not want one of those 500 million umbrellas cranked out in the factories of Shanghai, China, and I don't want one of the 5,000 types offered on Amazon. I want a gorgeous, handmade umbrella that will keep me dry, remain intact, be too precious to leave behind, and even turn a few heads. That means I want an umbrella crafted by Mario Tallarico, who is one in his 80s. He doesn't sell his umbrellas online. To buy one, you must go to a shop in Naples, Italy, the same shop where his great-grandfather began making the umbrellas by hand in 1860, and where Tallarico's nephew, also named Mario, is a fifth-generation apprentice. And so I buy a ticket to Naples. I arrive during a record-breaking heat wave, which the Neapolitans have named fittingly Lucifer. There is no rain in sight, just hazy blue skies and a blistering sun. Sweating and slightly miserable, I find the tiny shop on Vico Due Porti a Toledo, an undistinguished alley in Quartiere Spagnoli, the old Spanish district of Naples. The shop is marked by the ubiquitous cornicelli, red horns, to ward off Malacchio, the evil eye. The horns outside of Tallarico are as tall as a 10-year-old child. Inside sits Tallarico himself, carefully shaping the curved cane, of an umbrella from the wood of chestnut trees sourced right here in Naples. Tallarico's umbrellas are all made from local wood, lemon wood from Sorrento, the juniper trees on Vesuvius. Tallarico is part of the fabric of Naples, where artisans have been hand-carving elaborate nativity scenes on Via San Gregorio Armeno since the 13th century, and craftsmen like lovemaker Mauro Squalesi, who hand-cuts the leather and sews his gloves on non-electric Singer sewing machines, still thrive. Tallarico smiles at us when we enter, but doesn't stop working. He sits on a 200-year-old bench, which has been here since the shop opened. Beneath photos of himself with celebrities is a picture of Padre Pio, who died in 1968. Tallarico grew up surrounded by umbrellas, even as a child sleeping in the drawers of a chest in the family shop. Using the same methods as his great-grandfather, he is one of the only umbrella makers in the world who still forges the canes himself, slowly shaping the 180-degree curve with steam. He may be the sole umbrella maker to create a solid stick umbrella with a single-shaved staff, known as the Asta Entero method, which shows off the wood and leaves it intact in one piece. Those canes are finished with a polished buffalo horn tip. The canopy, or the sky of the umbrella, is closed with a mother-of-pearl button slipped through an embroidered ring, and those canopies, made of a very special waterproof blend of silk and polyester that brings to mind topaz and lapis and ruby. It takes 7 hours to make one umbrella, start to finish. Only 220 umbrellas are sold a year. One in 2017 was made especially for Robert De Niro, and not one of them looks like any of the others. Tallarico's nephew apprentice leads us around the corner to an equally small shop, where there are seven more umbrellas, not seven. I have to step outside in order to open one, and when I do, it makes a pleasing snap as the fabric spreads and falls into perfect place. There are stripes and small polka dots, a chartreuse one with a coppery brown underside. All these umbrellas are solid, heavy, stately, and sell for around 200 euros. All right, check your wallet. Here you go. That's 243 American dollars each. For a unique umbrella, a work of art, and something that will get you through every storm, the price seems reasonable. I choose a royal blue and gold striped umbrella for myself, a sky blue flecked with red for my husband. Both are made with local chestnut, the cane showing off the whorls and gnarls. I can imagine navigating rainy streets beneath one of these umbrellas. Can almost hear the sound of raindrops dancing across the top, and me safe and dry. As umbrellas around me turn inside out in the wind, as their flimsy metal snaps, I am practically singing in the rain, owner of a magnificent, one-of-a-kind umbrella. The relentless heat and sunshine await me when I step back outside, but as a sign in Mario Tallarico's shop reads, give yourself the gift of an umbrella. If it's not raining now, it soon will. I can hardly wait. And accompanying the article is a Made in Naples sidebar, which you might find interesting. It says, in Naples, perhaps more than anywhere else in Italy, craftsmanship is handed down through the centuries. Today, Neapolitan artisans are bringing their work into the present, fusing tradition with innovation. Nativity scenes. The ceramics workshop La Scarabattola reimagines the Presepio, the Christmas nativity scene. Hand-sculpted and painted figures include priests, devils, angels, even mermaids. And you'll find this one at Via dei Tribunali 50. That's the address, just in case you wanted to know. Then we have gloves. At Omega, Mario Squillaci and his son continue a glove-making workshop founded by Gennaro Squillaci in 1923. Lambskin gloves, lined with silk or cashmere, come in a rainbow of colors. And they're at Via Stella 12. Porcelain. Flower bouquets, fairies, and Vespa scooters are rendered by Naples' top porcelain artisans at Porcellane dei Capodimonte, dating from 1743. And this one's by reservation only. So if you want to check out the porcelain in Naples, you got to do it by reservation. And you can do it online at capodimonteporcelain.com/en/. Here you go. You ready? Again, that's Capodimonte, Capodimonte, Capodimont porcelain.com/en. And then we have tambourines. Yep. Tambourines of all sizes, some hand-painted with shapes or scenes of Naples, and they fill a Officina della Tamara, a traditional musical instrument workshop that also makes castanets. So get your dance vibes ready and go get a castanet at Vico San Severino 39 in good old Naples, Italy. What a trip that was. Wow. By the way, if the name Ann Hood sounds a little familiar, she is the author of the memoir Morning Star, Growing Up with Books, and her latest novel is The Book That Matters Most. Warmer weather's here, as if you have to be told, and as writer Kimberly Button suggests, when the weather gets hot, cool off at these natural wonders. In her article, we find, and it's called Waterfall Walks, in the May-June 2018 issue of AAA Go magazine, so let's take a walk. Rushing water cascading off the side of a rocky cliff is a sight to behold, and you don't have to be an accomplished hiker to experience them. Anyone can explore numerous waterfalls in the Carolinas without venturing too far from the road. In fact, many of the best ones to visit are just a quarter mile from a parking area. Those are some of the most awe-inspiring waterfalls that will have you reaching for your camera to capture a stunning photo without breaking a sweat. First up, Transylvania County, North Carolina. Known as the Land of Waterfalls, the region around Brevard, North Carolina, has over 250 waterfalls to explore. In fact, the destination is said to have the highest concentration of waterfalls in the United States. You can request their official waterfall guide at visitwaterfalls.com. That's visitwaterfalls.com. Looking Glass Falls, considered one of the most photographed waterfalls in America after Niagara Falls, this stunning roadside waterfall is easily accessible. Located in Pisgah National Forest, the 60-foot waterfall is named after Looking Glass Rock, which shimmers like a mirror when frozen water on the surface glistens in the sunlight. The top viewing area is accessible for those with mobility issues, with additional lower platforms getting guests closer to the mist and the opportunity to swim in the water at the base of the falls. Hooker Falls, found in DuPont State Recreational Forest, this iconic waterfall was featured in The Last of the Mohicans. It was named after Edmund Hooker, an area mill operator in the 1800s. The quarter-mile walk from the parking lot is flat and easy, lined with sandy banks of the Little River. The base of the falls provides a pool perfect for swimming. And want to keep exploring? Well, head to Bridalveil Falls and nearby Grassy Creek Falls, also in DuPont State Forest. And by the way, I have gone through parts of these areas when I visited in the Brevard area, and it is an easy trip, but I will warn you, it gets very popular during the summer months, and so the parking could be a little tight. And then we have Sliding Rock Falls. This Pisgah National Forest attraction is one of the most beloved destinations in Transylvania County. Kids and adults love sliding down into the frigid waters of the waterfall to a pool below. If you aren't brave enough to try the natural water slide, it's just as much fun to stand on the handicapped accessible viewing platform and watch the daredevils. There is a $2 parking fee collected between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Batson Creek Falls and Conestee Falls. I located near Brevard. One stop at the parking area leads to views of two different waterfalls. The handicap accessible location offers a short path to Batson Falls with a view of the top of Conestee Falls, okay? And then we have the White Waterfalls, the tallest waterfall east of the Rocky Mountains. It's located across North Carolina and South Carolina state lines. The Upper White Waterfalls, 411 feet tall in Nantahala National Forest near Sapphire, with an additional 400-foot drop from South Carolina's Lower White Waterfalls. The quarter-mile walkway to the upper overlook is wheelchair accessible. Stairs lead to a lower viewing deck. There is a $2 parking fee for vehicles. Jackson County, North Carolina. Dry Falls, it's rare to be able to walk behind a waterfall, but that's what you'll find at Dry Falls near Highlands. Quarter-mile trail leads to a surprisingly accessible waterfall in the Calasadja River in Nantahala National Forest. The trailhead's viewing platform of the falls is wheelchair accessible. Further down the path is a paved trail that meanders behind the 65-foot drop for a cool respite from summertime heat. The short, easy walk and the chance to stand under a waterfall make this a family favorite. Upstate South Carolina, well, we have Twin Falls. An easy quarter-mile walk from the parking area reveals two waterfalls, a large 75-foot drop partnered with a shorter waterfall to the side. Twin Falls is also known as Reedy Cove Falls, Rock Falls, and East Toe Falls, but the 15-minute walk to this double wonder is singularly unique. And then we have Falls Park on the Reedy. This 32-acre urban park is located in the heart of downtown Greenville, South Carolina. Combine an accessible walk to a 28-foot waterfall with shopping, dining, and even a zoo nearby. And you want to get more steps in? The 14-mile Swamp Rabbit Trail is a multi-use greenway along the river. So there you have some fun there. If you want to travel and find a little water experience this summer, those falls are great, okay? And again, that's from the April-May issue of AAA Go Magazine and Kimberly Button's article, Waterfall Walks. And so we certainly hope you've enjoyed that. And that's going to bring us pretty much to the end of another session of our Armchair Traveler. We have lots of fun coming up for you in future episodes. Don't forget our 50 States Road Trips continues in the next episode. We hope you'll be staying tuned for that. We've run out of time for our today's episode, and we certainly hope you'll listen next time, that you've enjoyed your journey today. And I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.